This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We lost some great people in the past year. Authors Kurt Vonnegut and Norman Mailer, singer Luciano Pavarotti, baseball's oldest Hall of Famer Phil Rizzuto, and a bright young football star, Sean Taylor. Boris Yeltsin, the Reverend Jerry Falwell, Lady Bird Johnson, and most recently, of course, former Pakistani Prime Minister Benazir Bhutto. And as great as the loss was, all of them got their due. Today, several NPR colleagues join us to talk about people who made a difference but did not get the attention they deserved, and we want to hear from you, too. If there's anybody you knew or knew of who contributed something important and died in 2007, give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org, and you can also post an obituary on our blog. That's at npr.org/blogofthenation. We begin with NPR senior correspondent Juan Williams, also among my predecessors as host of this program. Juan, Happy New Year. Thanks for joining us.
Happy New Year, Neil. Good to be with you.
And tell us about Oliver Hill.
Well, Oliver Hill was a prominent civil rights lawyer, but prominent really in Virginia, Neil, not known to much of the country. He died in August at age 100, August 5th this year. And I got to tell you, of all the people I've met writing about race relations in the United States, covering incidents of racial discrimination alike, Neil, this is the person who, to me, really stands out, head and shoulders above others. Not just saying that because he was a very tall, elegant man, but because of the kind of strength of personality, strength of character. You got to understand that he is someone who, going back to 1940, was battling in the capital of the Confederacy, Richmond, to end discrimination in terms of pay for black and white teachers. He was arguing that black teachers deserved to be paid the same as white teachers, and won that case in 1940. And then in 1951, working with Spotswood Robinson, another black Howard University Law School graduate, Oliver Hill went to court to represent, really, was about 117 students in Prince Edward County, Virginia, a very small rural county. The biggest town there is Farmville, Neil.
Farmville.
And he was there with a young woman named Barbara Johns, who was 16 years old and who had led the black students at Moton High School in a protest against the segregated and inferior facilities there at the school as compared to what was available to the white students at the white high school, Farmville High. And Spotswood Robinson, Oliver Hill show up, and, you know, they say, you know what, we'll represent you, but, you know, you've got just about no chance. Even some of the black parents in the county were not in support of it, and so they had to really make a case of this, and it's one of the five cases that then becomes what's universally known as Brown v. Board of Education, the landmark 1954 case that broke apart segregation, legal segregation in America's public schools. And you go back to the root of that, and right there you find Oliver Hill.
And did he play a role in the Supreme Court case as well? We, of course, remember Thurgood Marshall playing a big part in that.
Oh, of course. You know, I wrote a biography of Marshall, and Hill was Marshall's good friend from Howard University Law School, and he had been a regular advisor throughout the entire process. You got to understand, these people were tied in, and again, everybody knows Thurgood Marshall's name because he goes on to become a Supreme Court justice, not only the lead counsel in the Brown case, but a Supreme Court justice. But Oliver Hill was there all along and working at the grassroots level, specifically in Virginia, to break through cases. It's been estimated he won, you know, more than $50 million worth of cases in terms of pay equity, breakthroughs in terms of everything from seating on buses to justice. He ran for the state legislature in the Old Dominion, lost because of segregationist tactics by the machine there, but then went on to become the first black person to sit on the city council in Richmond since Reconstruction. So he was fighting all along. He and Marshall really were, you know, people who benefited from the dean at Howard University Law School, a man by the name of Charles Hamilton Houston. Houston had been and gone to Amherst, gone to World War II as a second lieutenant, then on to Harvard Law. And you think of that as compared to the opportunities that someone like a Barack Obama has today. Barack Obama also went to Harvard Law, and Barack Obama, as you know, became the editor of the Harvard Law Review. Charles Hamilton Houston was the first black student to sit on the Harvard Law Review, and one of the people that he created was this giant of Virginia law and civil rights law in America, Oliver Hill.
His passage comes at a time, it seems we're losing a generation.
I couldn't agree more, Neil. You know, it seems like time's passed. It's when you lose a generation, I think you lose sort of corporate memory, and you lose exactly an understanding of what people were fighting for and how difficult their struggles were. We know about the difficulty of struggles today, but you know, you look back at something like, imagine Oliver Hill going into a courtroom in the old Confederacy there, the capital, the old Confederacy, Virginia, and you know, people saying to him in the case in the Davis versus Prince Edward County case, it's the mores of the time. There's no injury to people by having separate and unequal schools. There's no injury to either race. Case dismissed. That's what Oliver Hill was standing up against. And Oliver Hill was not the kind of person to shout or curse. He was the kind of person who would try to reason. Very well educated, very much a man with a Southern drawl. I considered him a Southern gentleman. And that's the way he carried himself. It was just that he was persistent and confident in the idea of racial justice in America. And that's what makes him such a beacon. You know, even after his death, people were gathered. You know, President Clinton gave him the Freedom Medal, which is the highest civilian honor that any American can get. There was a reception for him just before he died, sold out, Neil, in Richmond. There, you know, federal court buildings named after him in Virginia. But again, nationally, few people know who was Oliver Hill.
Juan, thanks very much for reminding us.
You're welcome, Neil. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you. And Juan Williams, senior correspondent for NPR, with us today from his home here in Washington, D.C. Who do you think did not get enough attention upon their passing in 2007? Our number is 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. Let's talk with Martha, and Martha's calling us from Burns, Oregon.
Hello.
Hi there.
Hi. I'm remembering the hiker Colin Fletcher. He was a very important person who published a book, The Man Who Walked Through Time, in 1968, and it chronicles his walk through the Grand Canyon. And I think because of his work, a lot of us became avid backpackers and hikers and learned to appreciate the outdoors.
And what effect did he have on your life in particular?
Well, he taught me a lot about how to put a pack together, how to walk across large distances, and to be a geographer.
To be a geographer, and that's what you do?
Yes.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
And Happy New Year to you.
Same to you.
Bye-bye. Let's talk now with Judy, and Judy's with us from Overton Park in Kansas.
Good afternoon. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you, too. I wanted to remember a local person here in the Kansas City area, a man named Larry Stewart, who was the Secret Santa of Kansas City.
Huh.
I don't know the whole story, but at one point in his life when he was a young man and he was on hard times, somebody gave him $20. And after that, I think he became a fairly wealthy gentleman, and he started handing out $100 bills around Christmas time every year to needy people. And he'd, you know, kind of sneak up on them and secretly give them this money, and it's an incredible story, honestly.
Was he one of those rare individuals who also did not seek to have any recognition for this?
Yes, indeed. Yes, yes. Hmm. So, and in fact, honestly, his effort continues because other people have taken up the
mantle, if you will.
Yes.
Okay.
That's a perfect word. Thank you. And, in fact, the effort has spread to other cities in the country who want to do the same thing.
Well, thank you for reminding us about Larry Stewart, the Secret Santa of Kansas City.
That's exactly right.
Okay. Bye, Judy.
Thank you for your time.
Okay. And let's see if we can go now to Greg. Greg with us from Casper, Wyoming.
Yeah, hi.
Hi, Greg. Who should we remember who died in 2007?
Well, a friend who recently passed away on the 23rd of this December, Bill Rohrbach, up in Cody, Wyoming. He was a great man who touched everyone that he met, and he's the father of a good friend of mine here in Casper, and I'm just happy that I got to know him for the short time that I did.
You said he was a great man. What made him great?
Well, he was an attorney up there in Cody, and I think everyone that met him left with a smile on their face. He had the most wonderful sense of humor, and I think that's so important in the world today.
So it sounds like he was a great human being.
Yes, yes, unquestionably.
Well, thanks very much for the call, Greg.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. And let's see if we can go now to, this is Eric, and Eric's with us from Hover in Montana.
Close enough. It's Havre, actually.
Havre. All right. I was thinking about the place in Maryland, which also has that harbor name in French, but pronounces it differently. But go ahead.
Yeah, I was kind of chuckling with Brett Favre because you pronounce the R before the V, never mind that it's the other way around. Anyway, now my nominee, I guess, and I'm surprised that a lot of people haven't picked up on this more, was the passing of D. James Kennedy, the pastor of Coral Ridge Presbyterian Church in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. He was kind of one of the, I don't know that he was a founder of the moral majority movement of the 80s, but he certainly was one of the kingpins once it got rolling, and was very much a spokesman for Christian morality, you know, depending on how you wish to, you know, take all that stuff. But he certainly was one of the major influences in the 80s Christian conservative movement.
Some of those guys could come off sounding a little bit intolerant. Was he one of those?
I know how it sounds. It sounds intolerant, but rather I think he took it upon himself as that we've gotten away from a lot of the morals and whatnot that really kind of helped found the country. And, you know, again, I'm trying to keep theology out of it. He's just, you know, he's coming more from a moral perspective. And, sometimes he came off sounding kind of pompous. I would have to agree with you on that one. At the same time, he was a very well-learned man and actually a very caring man, too, from everything I've been able to understand. And, like him or hate him, you have to acknowledge him along with Jerry Falwell as one of the kind of the kingpins of the evangelical movement and the moral majority, certainly.
Eric, thanks very much for the suggestion.
Well, Happy New Year to you.
And Happy New Year to you.
Bye-bye.
We're remembering some of the people we lost in 2007 with our friends and colleagues here at NPR, and of course you too. 800-989-8255. Email is talk@npr.org. Talk of the Nation producer Marina Giovanelli suggested we remember Cuban musician Fausto Oramas, who was still a working musician when he died at the age of 95. A member of the Cuban band the Buena Vista Social Club, his most notable contribution was composing this worldwide hit called Candela. I'm Neil Conan. Stay with us. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're remembering people who passed away in 2007. We've asked our colleagues here at NPR for their suggestions of people who did not necessarily make the front page, but still made important contribution. Richard Harris, director of afternoon programming here at NPR News, suggested we remember a master of parody, Bill Strauss, who founded the satirical music group The Capitol Steps. Here he is during the Reagan administration performing the song Working 9 to 10.
Working every day in the Oval Office, thinking up anecdotes and sophistries, my working day has just begun. 9 a.m., my blood's not pumping, wonder which staffer's Nancy been dumping, check that clock, thank God I'm almost done. Working 9 to 10, putting total effort in it, that's my regiment, 60 solid working minutes as your president. I won't cut that any smaller, I get free rent and $200,000.
The late Bill Strauss of the Capitol Steps. In early November, NPR's Soraya Sahadi Nelson reported on a memorial service for three U.S. paratroopers killed in Afghanistan. Staff Sergeant Michael Gable delivered this eulogy for his friend and fellow Staff Sergeant Larry Rugel.
I will not be bitter. I will not shed any tears of sorrow. I am proud to have known such a good man and a warrior to the bitter end. Until we see each other again, Sky Soldiers!
In a terrible coincidence, Michael Gable was himself killed in mid-December. Joining us now from the NPR compound in Baghdad is Soraya Sahadi Nelson. She's NPR's bureau chief in Afghanistan, obviously on duty in Baghdad at the moment. Soraya, thanks for taking the time to be with us today.
Pleasure to do it, and Happy New Year to you.
And Happy New Year to you, too. Tell us a little bit about Sergeant Michael Gable.
Well, he was a very intense young man that I had the pleasure of meeting at this memorial service, which was a very sad event. But he was very determined and very upbeat and really did a good job, I think, in trying to persuade his comrades that they needed to push on. His brother David tells me he was a firm believer in Afghanistan, and that certainly came across in the short time that I got to meet him. And it just really put a face on something that we oftentimes forget about, especially as journalists, you know, that the soldiers are out there doing doing this work, you know, we always get caught up in the politics of it. But for them, it's very black and white, and it's very difficult, and they have to persevere, and they don't really have the option of having opinions about it. And he sort of personified that intensity and that drive with which they do what they do out there.
And many of us may feel badly every time we hear about the death of a soldier. For these men, sometimes it's their best friend. It's very personal.
Yes, in this case, it was his best friend that he was eulogizing when I met him. And he told some really sweet anecdotes about how he was a really good father to his 2.5-year-old daughter, Carmen, and how the two of them actually got to see Pope John Paul II in a very strange meeting, sort of, or it was just one of those things that happened while they were in Rome, where they allowed some nuns to get ahead of them in line on the way to St. Peter's, and the nuns turned around and handed them some tickets that allowed them access to an event at which John Paul II was speaking. And it was a very moving event. He spoke of this at the memorial service in Konar province for his friend, Staff Sergeant Larry Rugel.
Hmm. Did Sergeant Gable stand out from other soldiers that you've met?
Well, he did, particularly at this memorial service, where a lot of people were just questioning, like, why are we here? We're in this valley, the Korangal Valley, which is a very intense place for American soldiers. There's a lot of firefights that go on there. I mean, this is a mountain that has been filled with fighters and people just fighting and for decades. And so it's a very intense place. And where the others were sort of like, wow, it's two steps forward and five steps back, I mean, he was just very determined. Like, this was the right place to be. This was the right thing to do. In fact, he was about, his brother said he was going to reenlist next year for a fourth tour in Afghanistan. This was his third tour when he was killed. And he just seemed, in that sense, he really stood out for me because he was very determined and very strong in his beliefs that this was the right thing to do, that bringing education and bringing construction and just, you know, bringing a different kind of life to Afghanistan was worth this sort of effort.
You mentioned his brother David. Is the rest of his family as supportive of the war as he was?
Well, they certainly seem to be, and in fact, in an email to me, David said the most important thing was to remember that Michael really believed in what he was doing and believed in Afghanistan. I think it's also noteworthy to mention he actually was a 5-star chef, according to his brother, and he would buy fish and livestock and vegetables at the local market in Afghanistan, and with seasoning sent from home, he was from Baton Rouge, Louisiana, he would cook up food for the troops who get very tired of MREs, you know, meals ready to eat out there in the field. So it was sort of a treat, I think, to have him along.
You don't have to eat many MREs to get tired of them.
That's very true.
Thanks very much, Soraya. We appreciate your time, and take care of yourself. Happy New Year.
Thank you. Same to you. You're welcome.
Soraya Sarhadi-Nelson, Bureau Chief for NPR in Afghanistan, with us today from the NPR compound in Baghdad, Iraq. And again, we'd like you to join us. Who should we remember who passed away in 2007, who made an important contribution? 800-989-8255. Email is talk@npr.org. And Eric is with us. Eric calling from Lansing, Michigan.
Hi.
Hi.
I wanted to remember Donald Osterbrock. He was an astrophysicist out in California that died this year.
And what was his contribution?
He ended up about 40 or so years ago writing what would become the book that everyone would use for studying any type of gas out in space, called Astrophysics of Gaseous Nebula.
And it sounds like it was hardly a bestseller, but it might have had some influence.
Every astronomer that's picked up a book since him has had to almost certainly pick this book up and has used it regularly.
And it sounds like you're among them.
Yes. Yeah, I am.
And to what use have you put it?
I study star forming regions, places where stars are born, and to understand how to, you know, understand the light and to transform that into some meaningful understanding, use the book to, you know, go back to physical conditions. Pretty pictures to light, you know, pretty pictures to science, really.
Well, thanks very much. And he passed away this past year?
Yeah, he passed away in January.
Well, thanks for remembering him.
Okay, well, thank you.
Appreciate the phone call. Farai Chidea, the host of NPR's News and Notes, remembers filmmaker St. Clair Bourne, who was a pioneering member, a pioneering producer of more than 40 documentaries depicting African-American lives. His work included portraits of Gordon Parks, James Baldwin, Amiri Baraka, and Langston Hughes. He was 64 years old. And let's see if we can get to Don. And Don's with us from Washington in Mississippi.
Hello.
Don, you're on the air.
Oh, thank you for taking my call. I wanted to bring up the name of Irish folk song legend Tommy Makem.
Sure, the Clancy Brothers and Tommy Makem.
Yeah, he passed away in August this past year. And I'm not Irish myself, but I think I speak for millions of Americans that were grateful that he was so responsible in introducing American culture to Irish folk song culture going back to the 1950s when it was sort of buried and unheard of.
And in what way did he touch your life in particular?
I like the way that he, I've always been attracted to traditional music and folk song, but he brought a joyful and blue-collar and masculine approach to folk music at a time that it was very nerdy and collegiate with groups like the Kingston Trio and Peter, Paul, and Mary, and he injected a more just an average person blue-collar approach to folk music that was desperately needed.
Okay.
And as a musician, he introduced the people of the United States to the tin whistle and the people of Ireland to the five-string banjo, which probably helped popularize country music and bluegrass music in the British Isles. And he also touched me in a way that he always dealt with themes of universality in traditional music instead of provincial or xenophobic themes. And I think that that's important in the world we live in. And I think that was played out by the fact that he started a folk festival in Northern Ireland as a way to bring people together, and it may have in some way tangentially helped the peace process there.
Well, Don, thank you for helping us to remember Tommy Makem.
Okay, thanks for taking my call. You have a good year.
And Happy New Year to you, too. Joining us here in Studio 3A is NPR senior producer and currently a Nieman Fellow at Harvard University, Walter Ray Watson. And Walter, thanks very much for coming in today.
Thanks very much, and Happy New Year.
And Happy New Year to you. And Walter, you want to talk about Dr. Laurel Keith.
Yes, I want to remember my pediatrician. I grew up in Chicago in the 1960s and 70s, and Dr. Keith, besides being a fantastic pediatrician, and I'll talk a little bit about that in a moment, is remarkable for a number of reasons. He grew up in Cassopolis, Michigan, excuse me, and was the son of a day laborer and a maid. He found his way into the army, into the elite group of Tuskegee Airmen, the 992 who became Tuskegee Airmen, and eventually became a doctor after that. And he opened one of the few black-run practices of medicine on the west side of Chicago in the 1960s when there were very few private practices or doctors available to us. And he was just a beacon of hope, of intelligence, of confidence, of determination, because although there were, as you know, 900-plus black soldiers who became pilots, more than those 992 were turned out of that program. He never saw combat because the war was over before he was completely trained, but he actually went through that, served in the Civilian Conservation Corps, and on the GI Bill went back to school. He first went to Dillard University, then to the Army, and then went back to school on the GI Bill, eventually getting to Harvard Medical School, one of the few African Americans at the time to do that.
Tuskegee Airman, this is a great accomplishment. Harvard Medical School, a great accomplishment.
Oh, yeah.
In that day in particular, but any day. And yet some people might have said, wait a minute, private practice in Chicago, shouldn't he have aimed higher?
Well, actually, I don't think he could have aimed higher. The burgeoning population of black folk, both on West and South sides, needed doctors, needed everything. And his practice was, I mean, anytime you came there, the waiting room was just filled to the gills with patients, with children, boys, girls, and their mothers seeking help, seeking treatment. He kept that practice open for 15 years on the West Side before moving it to Rush Medical Center. And he always had had an affiliation with Presbyterian St. Luke's Hospital.
Mm. You mentioned he was your pediatrician. I think he was your pediatrician until you were 19?
Actually, yes, yes. Intermittently, during my high school years, when I would need to see a doctor, I would go to him because I hadn't quite made the transition to seeing adult doctors. And the story I wish to share is about just how he influenced who I became. Throughout my childhood, he tried to push me to become a doctor myself, and he, in fact, helped others become doctors. He had helped them get into medicine by helping to pay for their education. But in my case, he just kept pushing for that, and when I ultimately decided not to go into medicine but into journalism, the pangs of guilt of not serving in that capacity but still finding compassion, finding a way to serve the greater good and the greater public still stays with me today.
Walter Ray, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Walter Ray Watson, NPR senior producer, currently a Nieman Fellow at Harvard University, remembering his pediatrician, Dr. Laurel Keith. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get another caller on the line. This is Lisa. Lisa calling us from Ann Arbor in Michigan.
Hi, Neil.
Hi there. Happy New Year.
I'm calling about a local person who passed away this year in Ann Arbor named Audrey Simon. And Audrey was really instrumental and fundamental in bringing infant massage therapy to our community and really touched the lives of so many people in the Ann Arbor area and in the community, and was really committed to community and health and support for new parents and their babies.
And how is the community different because of her?
Well, I think there are so many families whose babies are sleeping soundly at night because of Audrey. She also, in this time of real corporate power, she was someone who studied herbs and flowers and natural healing, and was a really strong component in an alternative health care in Ann Arbor.
Well, thanks very much. Appreciate it.
Yes. Yeah, thank you.
Bye-bye, Lisa.
Bye.
And let's go now to, this is Roger. Roger with us from Gainesville in Florida.
Yes, how do you do?
Very well, thank you. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to yourself. I wanted to talk about Dr. J. Robert Cade.
And he was in the news because he invented a now incredibly popular sports drink.
He invented the first sports drink. And that was really not even a touch of what the man was. Because the reason that he could invent the sports drink is because he was an expert in blood culturing.
In blood culturing?
Yes, because he was interested in blood culturing because he was the man who established transplants down here in the University of Florida. So he had to learn blood work to find out the compatibility and why rejections. And the reason that he was a doctor at all was the GI Bill. And the reason that he got the GI Bill was because he was drafted as a medic in the Navy, and he was put in charge of the medical care of well over 5,000 men before he was, at a very, very young age.
Mm.
So throughout his life, he's been very shy, very demeaning, demure, you might even call it, and just a wonderful fellow to be around, because he could actually describe what he was doing to even me, and I understood it.
Thank you for remembering Dr. J. Robert Cade, the inventor of Gatorade. Appreciate the phone call.
Thank you.
And Bob Boylan, the host of NPR's online music program All Songs Considered, suggested we play a little music today from Alice Coltrane, the wife of the great saxophonist John Coltrane, and Bob Boylan calls her his first jazz love. This is Triloka from her 2004 CD, Translinear Light. Today on Talk of the Nation, we're asking NPR colleagues and you to remember some of those who passed away in 2007 and may not have gotten the headlines they deserved. Andy Sporkin, NPR's Vice President of Communications, remembers Roger M. King, a leader in the world of TV syndication. Roger King made stars of people like Alex Trebek, Dr. Phil, and Oprah Winfrey. He died at the age of 63. And stepping now from behind her desk here at Talk of the Nation is TOTN editor and producer Barry Hardiman, who's with us here in the Studio 3. I can't say thanks for coming in. You're getting paid for being here today.
I am. Thank you.
But I know you wanted to talk to us today about Madeleine L'Engle.
I did. And this was one of these things, you know, you hear the news and you sort of give a little gasp. Madeleine L'Engle, of course, is best known for writing the science fiction children's classic A Wrinkle in Time, which I'm sure everybody is now remembering the cover of their Dell yellow cover of The Wrinkle in Time. But she actually... you know, this was quite an important book. It was a science fiction book. It was a classic. But she actually wrote over 60 books. I mean, she had this incredible oeuvre that included genres that we usually sneer at, such as science fiction, you know, young adult YA literature, which is actually literature, and, you know, fantasy, the kinds of things we usually relegate to that corner of the bookstore with shiny covers. But she really wrote beautifully and deeply about these things. And I think... for, you know, people my age, and I'm hopefully people now just reading these books, wrote about them in a way that she never talked down to children or to adults.
Well, even to adults. Why did she touch your life?
I think what I would say about that is that what she really wrote about was family. Even A Wrinkle in Time, which is ostensibly a book, a science fiction book, is really about the bonds of family and the bonds of love and about family warts and all. Her cycle, this enormous cycle that she did on the Austen family, it begins with Meet the Austens, and everybody should get that book, is this really wonderful cycle that really made me... you can really sort of grow up with it. And I think also she uses these very adult concepts to teach children about these important things in the world. I mean, she wrote about quantum physics. She wrote about marriage. She wrote about love. She wrote about family. She wrote about all of these things, which, you know, if you're a human being, you can relate to. And she wrote about them in a way that, you know, she's famous for saying that that if the book will be too difficult for children, for grown-ups, then you must write it for children. Because she had a deep respect for children.
I had the great good fortune to meet her once. I bought three books, the Wrinkle in Time series, for my daughter, who was then in a backpack on my back, still an infant. And Madeleine L'Engle looked at her and took the time to inscribe each of them individually to my daughter, these little time bombs she knew would explode in 10 years or so as my daughter got old enough to read them. It was quite touching.
Aren't you lucky? She was a swiftly tilting planet herself on your back.
Barry Hardiman, thanks very much.
Thank you, Neil.
Our editor here at Talk of the Nation, Barry Hardiman, with us in Studio 3A. Associate producer of On Air Fundraising, Amy Blasek, wants to pay tribute to Momofuku Ando. He was the founder of Nissan Food Products and invented that college staple instant noodle soup. And he died this year at the age of 96. Let's get another caller on the line, and this is Eric. Eric with us from Orangeburg in South Carolina.
How you doing?
Very well.
All right.
Happy New Year.
All right. Happy New Year to you. Three people I want to mention. Dr. Asa Hilliard, he was over the Fuller E. Calloway School of Education at Georgia State, and he often... took on issues of inequality in education, racial inequality in education throughout the country.
And we'll give you one more. We're asking people to limit themselves to one, but all right, one
Harry
more.
Harry Dent and Governor Robert McNair. Harry Dent, he developed a Southern strategy along with Strom Thurmond for Richard Nixon. And
back in 1968, and that's two.
And Harry Dent,
that's two, Eric, okay?
McNair... The governor,
we're trying to limit people to one apiece, so you've already had two, Eric, so thanks very much, and Happy New Year.
Sure.
We appreciate the phone call. Let's see if we can get another caller on the line, and this is Bob. Bob with us from Hollywood, Florida.
Hi, Neil.
Hi, how you doing?
I'm good, yeah. I wanted to pay tribute to C.C. Bryant.
C.C. Bryant, who is that?
Well, C.C. Bryant lived in Macomb, Mississippi, and he was 90 years old. He passed on December 10th. And he was perhaps the only person in Mississippi, part of the civil rights movement, who lived to see the street on which he lived named after him.
Hmm.
At his death, he lived on C.C. Bryant Drive. And C.C. Bryant, in 1954, took on becoming head of the NAACP in Macomb,
mm-hmm.
when the Brown decision took out. And then in 1961, from his little barbershop, he was actually president of the local railroad union. He worked as a crane operator for the Illinois Central from 1942 on. And he cut hair in a little barbershop, which got bombed at one point in 1965. But from his barbershop, he kept Jet magazines. And so he read in 1961 that Amzie Moore in Jet magazine was going to have voter registration workers come to work in the Delta. And C.C. wrote a letter to Amzie saying he would like some voter registration workers to come down and work with him. And so Amzie sent me down. I went down, and C.C. became my father in the movement. And we started from working in Pike County there in Macomb and then spread out into Walthall and Amick counties. And so that's how the voter registration movement in Mississippi really took root.
Extraordinary to go from having your shop bombed to living on a street named after you.
Exactly. I mean, C.C. is one of the heroes of this country.
Well, thanks very much for reminding of his life.
You're welcome.
Happy New Year to you. Civil engineer Herbert Saffer died in November at the age of 90. After serving in the Army during the Second World War, Saffer moved to Florida and within a couple of months experienced his first two hurricanes. At the time, there was no way to anticipate whether those storms would be relatively mild or tear his roof off. Eventually, with the help of weather satellites and Hurricane Hunter aircraft, Saffer devised a scale that categorized hurricanes by the amount of damage they could be expected to wreak. Later, Robert Simpson extended the scale to include damage from storm surge floods, and we've all learned what to expect from a Category 1 on the Saffer-Simpson scale, or a Category 5. In fact, the scale Herbert Saffer devised was built on top of the Beaufort scale, introduced in the British Navy in the 18th century. Scott Hewler wrote a book about Beaufort and scales called Defining the Wind, and he joins us now on the phone from his home in North Carolina. Nice to have you back on the program. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you, Neil.
And you conclude that Beaufort's genius, and I guess by extension Herbert Saffer's, was to recognize that measuring something that's invisible, the wind, is very difficult, and to understand that you can precisely measure its effects.
That's exactly right, Neil. Saffer, what I think is wonderful about him is that he's an engineer. He was trying to figure out how something happened and how to communicate what was going to happen. So his scale doesn't talk about wind speeds or wind forces or any of these sort of conceptual things. His scale breaks a hurricane down into whether it's going to blow down your local stop sign, up to whether it's going to rip the roof off of your house and everybody else's house. It's a wonderful extension of Beaufort's scale, which originally did the same thing, which Beaufort took wind and defined it according to how fast your boat was going to go or what sails your boat could hold in a high wind.
And the top of the Beaufort scale was the hurricane, winds over 75 miles an hour. His description, as I recall, was widespread devastation occurs, which is useful but rather vague.
Right, exactly. In fact, when Beaufort did it, he said he called a hurricane that which no canvas could withstand. If the wind blew your sails to pieces, then it must be a hurricane. And then the land scale that we now have of the Beaufort scale said, you're right, widespread damage. I think it even says devastation occurs.
Yeah.
And so Saffer follows right in those footsteps, which is using a few carefully chosen words and very specific actual physical examples to say this is what's going on. You know, currently when people talk about wind in their backyards and they say, well, here's what's happening to the lawn furniture, they're right in the tradition of both Beaufort and Saffer, who was, again, he was an engineer, and I think that's a wonderful thing. people love writers because they can do things. I think engineers actually make the best writers because they know what point they're trying to get across.
Finally, a Category 5 hurricane has winds up to 155 miles an hour, which can tear roofs off houses and completely destroy buildings. But is there a scale above that?
No, I think Saffer said that there was no point in that because his scale, again, was about, he got involved in making the scale because he was involved in a UN project to reduce hurricane damage to low-cost housing worldwide. And so he said that beyond that, if it's already destroying all the houses, what are you worried about? Just run. You know, there's nothing more to say about a hurricane once it's destroying everything in its path. Why make a higher number?
Scott Hewler, thanks very much. We appreciate your time today.
My pleasure being here. Happy New Year.
Scott Hewler wrote a book about Beaufort and scales called Defining the Wind, and he joined us today from his home in North Carolina to remember the civil engineer Herbert Saffer, who died in 2007. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And we wanted to add a couple of obits that listeners emailed to us. Mike in Menlo Park, California, wrote in to pay respects to Ted Corbett, often called the father of long-distance running. He was an ultra-marathon pioneer, helping to revive interest in the sport in the United States in the 1960s and 70s. New York Times columnist Robert Lipside called Corbett the last surviving spiritual elder of the modern running clan. Michelle in Traverse City, Michigan, also wrote in, "You asked who we mourn this year. I mourn my dad, Matthias L. Hepler, who died March 24, 2007. If you research the annals of the World War II carrier pilots and Air Group 2, you will find their bravery and antics were almost beyond the pale. For example, when my dad's plane and parachute were shot up, he made it back to the carrier on fumes, landed, pushed the plane into the Pacific, and sent the silk parachute home to my mother, who had it made into underwear." And finally, Philip of Reno remembers George Small, who passed last month at the age of 99. That in itself is noteworthy. However, George had been the oldest living survivor of the Bataan Death March of World War II. In addition to that, he survived the deplorable transport to Japan, the torturous treatment he and others received there, and in spite of it all, committed sabotage against the Japanese war machine. I found him to be a gentle machine. And now as we continue to remember some of the things that we've missed this past year, well, yesterday, the last day of the year, we gave you an email challenge to tell us your favorite quotes of 2007. We did not have time to get to them all yesterday, so here are a few more. This from Kathy in Madison, Wisconsin. "The best political quote of 2007 came from Joe Biden during a televised debate. That quote was on the subject of Rudy Giuliani." We have it on tape. Here it is.
Rudy Giuliani. I mean, think about it. Rudy Giuliani, there's only three things he mentioned in a sentence, a noun and a verb and 9/11. I mean, there's nothing else. There's nothing else.
Marjorie wrote in from Sacramento, California, to recall a moment from the UN Climate Change Conference held in Bali a few weeks ago. Kevin Conrad represented Papua New Guinea at the conference, and he had these words for the U.S. representative, Paula Dobrianski.
"We seek your leadership, but if for some reason you're not willing to lead, leave it to the rest of us. Please get out of the way."
And finally, we received this email from Alex. "Certainly the most ubiquitous quote of 2007 was, 'I don't recall,' from Alberto Gonzalez." Those words, of course, were uttered several times by then Attorney General Gonzalez during Senate hearings last April.
"What I knew about, I just don't recall the reason. The senator that I don't recall remembering, I don't recall the reason why. Senator, I don't recall sending a follow-up. I don't recall being a... Senator, I don't recall specifically the... I don't have any recollection about the mechanics of a..."
Alberto Gonzalez, thanks to all of our listeners who emailed us their suggestions.